Welcome to the Project Zion podcast. This podcast explores the unique spiritual and theological gifts Community of Christ offers for today's world.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Project Zion podcast. I'm your host, Brittany Mangelson, and today we have on a repeat guest that I'm very excited to have on. We have on Nancy Ross, who has shared with us her faith journey before. But today, she is going to talk to us about Fowler's Stages of Faith and how that relates to Latter-day Seeker ministry and movement between the LDS Church and Community of Christ. Welcome, Nancy. Thanks for coming on.
It's great to be back, Brittany. I'm glad to be here talking with you.
Nancy, you presented this material at both Sunstone Symposium in Salt Lake and then again at John Whitmer Association. I'm really looking forward to hearing what you have to say about it. So I guess my first question for you is just what interests you in this topic?
A couple of years ago, a colleague of mine who goes by the name Rob Lux, we started just doing this podcast. This was his idea of the Faith Transitions podcast. You can Google it and find just Faith Transitions podcast. And we started doing these interviews with people about what their faith looked like at different stages in their lifespan. And I had really no idea what to expect, if I'd be really interested in this. Rob just kind of approached me and asked. And I was like, sure, I'll try it. We'll see how that goes. And I really ended up loving hearing people's stories of faith. And I think I'd never really asked people questions about their faith in such in-depth and expansive ways. And doing the podcast really gave me an opportunity to ask a lot of very nosy questions to people I'm interested in, right? And I learned to see these stories as, well, I mean, I recognize them as being kind of beautiful expressions of faith, regardless of what they experienced and told us about in that podcast. But I also realized that like these were sacred. Like it was more than that they were beautiful. It's that they were really sacred, and there's something about this process of developing faith and faith developing over our different lifespans and throughout our lives that was just really compelling. And I really loved that experience. Rob and I presented at Sunstone together this last year what we had kind of learned or pulled from the podcast, and we got a bunch of transcripts of each of the interviews, and Rob did some kind of preliminary qualitative analysis and quantitative analysis on the transcripts. And I mean, I didn't say anything especially new or exciting, but I did during that time, but I did just kind of walk our audience at Sunstone through Fowler's Stages of Faith Development. I'm an art historian by training, so I used some images. So I just kind of grabbed some pictures online representing different faith stages, and that seemed to go down really well. And then I developed this idea of what I had learned for John Whitmer from some things that I had observed with people moving from Mormonism, from the Mormon feminist movement into Community of Christ.
Awesome. For our listeners who aren't familiar with Fowler's Stages of Faith, can you give us a brief overview and let us know what it's all about?
James Fowler was a scholar who was very interested in faith, but also in psychology. He was very familiar with stages of human development and Piaget and the life cycle that is studied in that discipline. And he kind of overlaid onto that human development life cycle stages of faith development. So we've got seven stages. And I am just going to borrow a little bit of text here from the Faith Transitions podcast that we use, where we had an outline of these different stages of faith. So the first stage is stage zero, and it's called a primal or undifferentiated faith, which is characterized by the learning of the safety of your environment. So this is like when you are an infant and a toddler, the kind, you know, you learn about trust and safety, and you learn about the divine from your caretakers. And that's what that's about. Doesn't seem to me to be a very exciting stage of faith, the faith of babies. Maybe other people would differ. The next stage is faith that is characterized by the psyche unprotected exposure to the unconscious, and religion is learned mainly through experiences, stories, images, and the people that one comes in contact with. And the image that I used for this particular slide was just an illustration of a Book of Mormon story, Lehi's family preparing to cross the sea and building boats. And so I know that certainly from my own faith development, that my dad read picture scriptures to us every morning, and that these stories, these abbreviated stories for children and the images that accompany them were very important to my faith. So I recognize that in my own life. Stage two is the mythic literal faith, where somebody has a strong belief in justice and reciprocity of the universe. And usually God looks like a person in that stage. And metaphors and symbolic language are often taken very literally. So literalism is very important in this stage. And the image, if you're looking for imagery to go with, I've just got an image of a judge's gavel and the scales of justice. So stage three is called the synthetic conventional stage, where faith is characterized by conformity to religious authority and the development of a personal identity. And any conflicts with one's beliefs are ignored at this stage due to a fear of threat from inconsistencies. And I have here an image. Some people might find this a little bit offensive, and so I apologize, but only like halfway, of a flock of sheep. And they all have sunglasses on. So that is their conformity to a particular idea that perhaps sheep should listen to their leaders by wearing sunglasses. I don't know. It was just an amusing photo. So I grabbed it. It's not deep, but conformity is really important. And I think something that's really important to note at this stage is that in the LDS culture, that conformity is very important. There is a strong sense that there are certain ways of behaving and very particular ways of believing and very particular kinds of dress and grooming standards that are expected in attending a Sunday meeting, and that in transgressing these shared expectations, there are a lot of social consequences for that, and that can be very tricky. And so often when I think of LDS faith or the faith the LDS church supports, I often think of stage three, because I feel like there's a lot of encouragement to conform and to really default to leaders' explanations of theological ideas and belief ideas, and to explain the world around me and to then absorb those ideas about the world. So a lot of like deferring to authority. But then there's a lot of conflict that comes in with stage four. Stage four is called the individuative reflective stage, and that's a stage of angst and struggle. And the image that I use to illustrate this particular stage is of a guy trying to push a big rock up a hill. And this isn't just like a rock. This is like an enormous stone that a single human being could never hope to move at all on your own. But there's just to reflect the sense of struggle and pushing and pulling and wrestling that happens at this particular stage, where an individual takes responsibility for his or her own beliefs and feelings, and they're able to reflect on their beliefs, and there's a new openness to a new complexity of faith, but also an awareness of conflict. And for any of you who have been through a stage four, it is that feeling of dread and angst and wrestle and not knowing, having let go of this idea of certainty, which is much more present in stages like one, two, and three. And it's in myself, I just experience that as a lot of like emotional pain and inner turmoil. Does that sound familiar to you, Brittany?
For sure. Yeah. It almost feels like the carpet has been pulled from underneath you and there's like china breaking everywhere, and it can be dramatic and
yeah,
very painful.
Yeah, so much drama, so much pain. And that's often a stage where a lot of people are looking for support online. And you and I have been involved with like online Mormon support communities, Mormon feminist communities, and just kind of broader Mormon support communities for a long time. And you're typically going to encounter a lot of people in those online communities who are in a stage four, right? And it's painful and it's messy, and you know it when you're there. And if you're recognizing some of the things that I'm saying in your own life, you know, that's stage four. And stage four is a really difficult stage. But then comes along stage five, which is the conjunctive faith, which acknowledges paradox and transcendence, relating reality behind the symbols of inherited systems. So the individual resolves conflicts from previous stages by a complex understanding of a multidimensional, interdependent truth that cannot be explained by any particular statement. And so that sounds like a lot of big words, but what I have as the illustration for that is like an M.C. Escher drawing where we have stairs going in a lot of different directions and people on those stairs in different directions to kind of symbolize the way in which when we're at stage five, that certainty that we may have held in a stage two or a stage three is long gone. It was deconstructed and broken down in stage four. But there is a piece that is made in stage five where we acknowledge that there are unresolvable conflicts and different ideas about faith, and that becomes just a little bit easier to tolerate. We're no longer looking for a one true answer or a one true idea or belief or theology, where we can accept that there are a lot of things that are good and that there may be some things that are not good, and that life is messy and complex and lived largely in shades of gray. And so that's seen as a resolution kind of stage. So one thing that Fowler articulates is that many people don't really, you know, like many people don't necessarily make it very far in this faith development process, and that, you know, many people may not make it beyond a stage two or a stage three. Not everybody is kind of guaranteed to make it all the way through. The last of these stages, stage six, is called the universalizing faith. Some people call that enlightenment. I'm not sure that that's the right term to apply here, but it's the individual would treat any person with compassion as he or she views people as being from a universal community and should be treated with universal principles of justice and love. And while all of that sounds good, something that many of our listeners may agree with, that people who enact this often enact this in a very big way, and that stage six is really associated with if you reach the kind of tremendous faith and love and activism of like a Martin Luther King, that you get, then you hit stage six. But I think the idea here really is that this is a stage that not many people, that's very difficult to reach, and that not many people do reach. But when people do reach it, they become real models in their community, you know, that the community is able to recognize as being, you know, like, wow, that is some powerful faith enacted for the purposes of justice and compassion and peace. Really, when we're talking about people's faith stages, we're on, a lot of discussion is going to be happening between stages two and five. And that's kind of what we're talking about.
Awesome.
So there's Fowler in a nutshell.
Yeah, that was a really good nutshell. I haven't actually, we have the book and I've briefly looked at it, but I feel like that overview gave me a lot more insight to what the stages of faith are. So thank you. What are the trends that you have connected with movement between the LDS Church and Community of Christ in relation to Fowler stages?
Okay, let's just talk about Mormon feminism for a minute. I've been involved in online Mormon feminism probably since about 2005. That's probably when I first encountered like the FMA, the Feminist Mormon Housewives blog, and then the Exponent blog, and then began to follow those communities regularly online, and eventually they developed into Facebook spaces and other social media platforms. And there's been a lot of podcasting in the last 5 years or so, and that's something that I study as an academic and have written some papers about and given a bunch of presentations. And so I've been following this community in its online spaces for a while, and I've been very interested in how different kinds of platforms have facilitated different kinds of interaction and development of this community. You know, like Facebook was hugely instrumental in getting the community to move toward activism. Since then, the community has been involved with activism since about 2011, 2012. And right now there has been a big focus on education, you know, and a lot of that happens through podcasts and blogs and other means. So this is a community that I've been watching for to try and observe trends and patterns of things happening. And one thing I was very aware when you, Brittany, when you started, you know, talking about Community of Christ and visiting Community of Christ, and then I know that like in January of 2015, you were confirmed, right, in Community of Christ. Mm-hmm. And so, and I remember that because you were very vocal about talking about that in like the Feminist Mormon Housewives Facebook group. And so I remember, you know, just kind of watching that and being a little bit odd, like, whoa, what is Brittany doing? You know, and also like super interested, like, whoa, that's so scandalous, and also very interested. So that was the space that I was in at that time. And so you were kind of talking about the different things in these groups that you had experienced in your kind of exploration of Community of Christ and then being confirmed and then your journey in Community of Christ since then. And what happened is that a little while later we see, or a few months later, we see other people being confirmed as well. And from what I have seen and from what I know of, that since January of 2015, so we're now, you know, almost a full 3 years later, almost, is that another about 10 Mormon feminists, people who were active in these Mormon feminist groups, have converted, like confirmed or baptized or both in Community of Christ. And we have a number of other people who maybe never officially converted, but participate regularly, and maybe they just haven't converted for a variety of reasons, but are active participants in Community of Christ. And so I found this to be very interesting and started thinking about, like, first of all, 10 doesn't, okay, so I get it, like 10's not a big number, you know, 10, but for such a small church as Community of Christ, and for a particular subgroup like Mormon feminism, that seemed like a lot to me, right? Like, it seemed like that's kind of a lot. And that's kind of a lot within the space of just a couple of years. And I certainly wasn't aware of, like, Mormon feminist movement to Community of Christ before this. And maybe there were Mormons who, you know, there were Mormons, right, who had, converted to Community of Christ. But I'm not really sure about the Mormon feminist movement specifically. And anyway, this was just something that I was observing. When I saw the call for papers come out for John Whitmer, the conference, Community of Christ's kind of historical conference, I thought, you know, I'm just going to write up a little abstract and just kind of send that in and see what happens. Conferences like John Whitmer and Mormon History Association, the kind of LDS version, are typically very focused on 19th century history, right? What did Joseph Smith do? What did Brigham Young do? And what did those early pioneers do? And a lot of Mormon studies is really focused very, very intensely on the history of 19th century people, specifically 19th century white men who served as leaders of the LDS Church and of different movements. And so I submitted an abstract, you know, which is a very contemporary topic, you know, largely talking about, like, social media and the involvement of people, like, in social media, which a lot of people feel like is a very fluffy subject in and of itself, but a different kind of history, a kind of contemporary history. And so I ended up developing this paper, and this is, I'm just going to talk about for just a minute about, like, what I did. So I knew that there were these little trickles of movement, but I wondered if there were other ways to kind of map this and to understand this a little bit better about this movement between not only of Mormons to Community of Christ or LDS people to Community of Christ, but specifically from the Mormon feminist movement. And so last year I was like super nerd and took some computer science classes and to do some jobs specifically about what I'm supposed to describe, which is that I was able to, you know, with some computer, you know, some Python scripts and pulling lots of information from Facebook, I was able to compile like a list of all the Mormon feminists from like 5 main Mormon feminist groups on Facebook. And that create an unduplicated list of names, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. So that, you know, there are a lot of people who were in the same Facebook groups. And so the list that I was able to create was an unduplicated list because computer science programs you can write them in such a way that, you know, you're able to see if things match each other and then remove them. And so I did that. But then I was able to kind of take a list of the Latter-day Seekers group on Facebook, which is a very big group with several thousand people, and say, well, how many people from the Mormon feminist group are also in the Latter-day Seekers group? And that number was over 300. So the overall size of the Mormon feminist group was 6,700 from these 5 groups. So lots of people. 300 of those people, those individuals, were also in the Latter-day Seeker group. And I was like, wow. And at the time when I pulled those numbers, which was in September, that was about 16% of the Latter-day Seeker group were Mormon feminists.
Wow.
And so you might be like, well, right. But like, you know, and people might be like, 15%, who cares? But that's actually significant because we haven't really done a lot of, I mean, to the best of my knowledge, we haven't really done a lot of research about like who were Latter-day Seekers, right? Other than people are who are, you know, are current or former Mormons or somewhere in that space. But, you know, so it's significant, a chunk, an identifiable chunk of this community that's relevant to us in Community of Christ, you know, are also in this other community or in this other Mormon feminist community. I was like, well, that's really interesting. You know, like we've got 10 people who've about 10 people who've made that journey all the way over from one group to the next, but surrounding that 10 are 300, right? Are 300 people. And so that's pretty significant. Yeah. So I was looking at all these different groups and then trying to explain, well, like, you know, like why is there this overlap? You know, like how did that happen? You know, why does that exist? You know, those sorts of questions. One thing I did was I did a lot of timelining. I looked at some of the work of, you know, Robin Linkhart, who's an apostle in Community of Christ, and John Hamer, who's the pastor of the Toronto congregation. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
And John Hamer, you know, was also a former Mormon and does a lot of historical work and shows up in a lot of progressive Mormon podcasts and, you know, blogs and various sorts of discussions that are happening within the progressive Mormon and former Mormon world online. But Robin Linkhart had a kind of quite intensive participation within the Mormon feminist movement from about 2013 onward, or at least that I was able to trace online, where she started doing things like presenting at Sunstone and being involved in the small Mormon feminist conference called Counterpoint, and being involved in very consistent ways. And I don't know exactly when she was pastor of the Salt Lake congregation, but you know, she was present in Northern Utah and able to kind of connect with these sorts of people, but was available to Mormon feminists in a variety of spaces to answer, often just kind of answer questions and just kind of, you know, be Robin. And Robin's kind of great. So that's a pretty good thing to witness. It's true. And so like I met Robin at a Mormon feminist kind of family camping retreat and asked her a lot of very pointed questions initially, which she answered very graciously and she continued to show up at that retreat year after year and always be kind of willing and available to kind of minister to people and to answer their questions, but just to kind of be kind of a solid person who could have a kind of comfortable faith of her own while being okay with the faith of people around her. And so she was my kind of like entry point into Community of Christ. But and just as a side note, like I only ever seem to study stuff that I'm like really heavily involved with because I'm trying to like understand my own life from a very academic point of view. So that's, yeah, whatever I'm involved in, that kind of ends up being what I'm writing papers about because that's, I'm just trying to understand my own context a little bit better.
I like it.
I'm sure lots of people do the same thing.
Yeah.
But just trying to understand what this is. And when I first had heard about Fowler on podcasts and various things before, and it had never really meant much. And certainly there are a lot of very legitimate critiques about Fowler and that, you know, some people would say that, well, you know, faith progression isn't necessarily linear in the way that Fowler presents it as linear. And I would argue that people with not white, straight, cisgendered identities may experience challenges to their faith in a different timeline than white cisgendered men might experience challenges to their faith in a particular timeline. And so that maybe there are certainly some problems with Fowler, but I think that this idea that the descriptions of the kinds of faith that we experience in life are fairly well described by Fowler, and whether or not we necessarily experience them as perfectly linear, if that makes sense, you know, easily moving from one stage to the next stage and never kind of moving backwards. Anyway, so there are certainly some very legitimate critiques of Fowler, but I think that there are some very useful things as well. And one thing that often doesn't come up when people are talking about Fowler and describing the faith stages, but is certainly present in a lot of the literature by Fowler, the scholarly literature, is that church leaders and church leadership should really be at a stage five place, because it's only from stage five that you can minister to people who are at a variety of faith stages, like in good faith and without necessarily trying with the strong impetus to change them. You know, something that Brittany, you and I will have seen from seeing a lot of people in pain in stage four is that there's a lot of anger in that stage. There's a lot of calling out. It can be kind of it can be a destructive phase for some people. And certainly some people just want to, like, in that stage, they want to tell everybody that the LDS church is wrong, and, you know, and they want to kind of actively tear down other people's faith. Not everybody, but certainly I've witnessed this. Yeah. But right, so, you know, like, if you're in stage four, you may not necessarily be able to minister very effectively to people at a variety of stages, because you have very strong ideas that you have not yet found a kind of solid, constructed foundation of state. Of faith. You're probably in a more deconstructed, very messy stage of faith.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. It makes perfect sense.
But once you move beyond that and kind of figuring out, okay, well, what are the important pieces that I'm going to take away from this deconstruction? What are my values now? And how do I enact that in a faith community or not in a faith community? And how do I put that together in a more kind of peaceful way that I can move forward with in a faith journey, that's a better stage to be ministering to people from. And when I read that, I felt like the bolt of lightning had hit my head, because it became so clear that, like, when I was last in a LDS ward and my leaders, church leaders in that ward were probably at a stage three, and that the messaging of the LDS church very much supports faith at a stage three. And that works really well if you are at a stage three. So, like, you're going to be really well supported in that stage. But when you move beyond stage three and the further you get into stage four, you know, the LDS church is not well suited to support faith at that stage. And then there are these tensions, because stage three is about conformity and about deferring to leaders, and stage four is about, like, deconstructing that and finding your own identity. So there's a lot of conflict in that stage. But that made a lot of sense to me, in the sense of, like, oh, well, you know, one reason why I could never find a lot of peace is in these later years of being LDS, I'm now Community of Christ, but was because I was at a stage of faith that my community couldn't support. And I feel like phrasing it in that way gives, like, everybody the benefit of the doubt, in the sense that, like, that community was acting in good faith because they knew how to do three and they didn't know how to do stage four. And so when I moved into that space, you know, I was really on my own, and I felt that. I felt very much on my own. But then in that stage of faith, I felt like I was well supported by my Mormon feminist community, because I felt like my Mormon feminist community could support my messy faith, right? And it could support my deconstruction, and I could be, and I had a lot of community with that. And so I felt like that was well supported. As time has moved on, I think the Mormon feminist community has grown to support people in state, like, through stage four, and maybe even just kind of barely getting to stage five, because a lot of people have kind of moved through that angst to a kind of peace with something, maybe not a very well-defined something, maybe sometimes a very well-defined something, maybe sometimes with a faith community and sometimes without a faith community, sometimes leaving LDS and sometimes staying LDS. But what I felt then, and I think one thing that drew me to Community of Christ was a sense that, like, the people that I was encountering, the experienced church leaders that I was encountering, they were kind of modeling a stage five faith, and they were modeling a wholeness and a peace and an acceptance of a variety of journeys without that causing a problem for them personally, or at least that's how I perceived it, if that makes sense. Right. Yeah. And that ability, Right. And when I meet, I've met in my short time of being, you know, a member of Community of Christ, I've met a lot of, you know, wonderful church leaders, and they often exude the sense of like, you know, like, here is my faith and here is your faith. And if those faiths look different, that's not a problem. You know, that's not, there's no conflict there. I mean, there can be conflict in community and living out different kinds of beliefs, and that's certainly messy on a congregational level, but there isn't like a theological conflict. Like, you know, we're not all bound by faith statements in the way that LDS people are often bound by faith statements, are encouraged to be adopting and generating good feelings about faith statements, where my Mormon feminist community in its deconstruction supportive stage 4 had moved from a kind of faith-based community to where people, we did share those values, or we did share those belief statements more or less, you know, years ago, but it had come to be more of a values-based community. We believe in inclusion. You know, obviously that's totally messy when it plays out in real life. But believing in valuing the worth of people, again, totally messy when it plays out in real life, but began to develop its kind of, and communicate its sense of shared values. And so I'm in this messy stage 4, and I'm seeing other people kind of move through this space. And I'm also seeing that in this other space, in this Community of Christ space, that there is a willingness and an openness and an ability to support this kind of different, you know, different levels and degrees of faith, but also that a lot of people are kind of modeling a really healthy stage 5, and seeing that as really desirable, if that makes sense. Sorry, I'm talking a little bit about my own journey and a little bit about what I think I've been seeing in other people. But yeah, so I think there's a sense that, you know, like, well, why would people move from LDS to Community of Christ? And there are a lot of reasons for that. You know, on, you know, from politics and political orientation to flexibility to historical problems to gender issues to LGBT issues to lots of things. But I think that one, and I was drawn to Community of Christ because of a lot of those things. But I think one reason why I stayed in Community of Christ and why I chose to become confirmed in Community of Christ was because I saw really healthy journeys, faith journeys modeled at this kind of stage 5 level. And I think that like, wow, that looks like some awesome peace and wholeness. And I kind of want some of that, if that makes sense.
Yeah. I love it. You've just verbalized so many things that I haven't been able to verbalize. So thank you. This is, it's fascinating for me because you verbalize so much of what I've been trying to verbalize with my own faith journey. Like when I decided pretty early on that Community of Christ could be a place for us, and I wasn't able to really articulate why I knew that, but I knew that my faith was still evolving, that it was still changing, and I could recognize that it was a safe place to do that. Like Community of Christ was a safe place to do that. So it wasn't, I mean, my theology, my personal theology has drastically changed from when I was first baptized, and I am in seminary, and that's helped a little bit, you know, but even just before that, I was still kind of borderline in a stage 4 when I came to Christ, but I think I could recognize that like, this is where stage 5 is. And so I'm going to cling to this because this is what I want to be, even though I'm not exactly where I want to be theologically yet. But I could recognize that, like I could get there in Community of Christ, but there was no way I'd be able to reach that in the LDS church. But yeah, so to kind of be able to follow Fowler is super helpful.
Right. And it's important to articulate that stage 5 faith is still going to look different for everybody. Right. And that's still going to be a very individualized thing, but it's not the place of fighting. It's not the place of like intense deconstruction. It's the place of being like, okay, well, I don't really, you know, whatever I believe or I don't believe right now, I'm okay with that. And I can see that, you know, faith is messy and that there are some contradictions here, and I'm just going to like, I'm going to play this out, right? And I'm going to play that out, but without the turbulence of stage 4. Does that make sense? Yeah. So there's still movement in stage five, and there can be still a lot of forward movement, and everybody's stage five will look different. There's no like one unified. When you're at stage five, it looks exactly like this, 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 or this. It's kind of coming to a place of peace with a lot of this stuff and being able to appreciate that there is a lot of nuance in faith and having let go of a lot of the black and white thinking that may have come with like stage two and stage three.
Yeah. Do you think that you can get to different stages of faith on different topics, I guess, at different times? Because like I'm thinking for me and Heavenly Mother, and I know like the mm-hmm. interview that I did with you on faith transitions, mm-hmm. like the concept of Heavenly Mother was huge in my faith experience when I was Mormon.
Right.
And mm-hmm. I've completely let that go for multiple reasons. Mm-hmm. Not that I don't. There's still like a feminine divine and the history behind the feminine divine. Like that's still interesting, but mm-hmm. as far as like picturing God as a woman, I don't necessarily do anymore. And I feel very much stage five of that topic. And I feel like I got there really quickly, like before I was necessarily in stage five on other topics. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Totally. And I think so. And I think that this is where I want to come back to this idea of everybody's stage five can look different. And I think that there's often in the stage four, there's a lot of, you know, I know that I certainly let a lot of things go and that other people let a lot of like beliefs and things that were previously very, very important. You know, I felt like I was kind of a spiritual minimalist, you know, when I ended up kind of walking away from that stage. I just had a few really kind of key concepts that were still important to me. And I was like, okay, well, I'm just going to work with this right now because this is about all I can hold on to. But I think that for you, moving into that stage meant a letting go. I think that for other people, it could be a holding on, but maybe a holding on and re-envisioning a Heavenly Mother, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Right. Like in a way that it could work for them with their current theology, which is probably different from a stage four theology and a stage three theology. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. And I think if I'm hearing you, it's like the underlying of, I don't have to tell you that you're wrong because I'm comfortable and secure in wherever I'm at.
Yeah.
I grant that people as well.
Right. And I think that my guess is that moving between faith stages is maybe messier than Fowler outlines with, you know, a little bit of going forward. And I think we certainly see, for those of us who have left the LDS faith, we can certainly see in our families and our extended friend circles, you know, sometimes a retrenching, you know, and a kind of maybe moving backwards slightly and you know, retrenching into us, you know, maybe we're friends and family members were previously a little more flexible. And then, you know, something political happens and everybody retrenches a little bit. They kind of move backwards a little bit in their faith into a place that feels secure and easy and confident and what they can really hold on to. And I know that I'm not sure that I believe Fowler and that all of this is perfectly linear, that we move, you know, we can only really move forward in this process.
It's all good.
Okay. But yeah, so I just want to reiterate, like, so you lost Heavenly Mother. I lost Heavenly Mother, but I think some other people may get to a stage five and still have Heavenly Mother. And maybe Heavenly Mother or their concept of the feminine divine is just different from, or there was just some key part of that was taken through through the kind of stage four process. Does that make sense?
Yeah, for sure.
Right. So it's again, so it's not like, oh, well, every, you know, your stage five isn't going to look like my stage five, but we can understand that there are good reasons. I can understand that there's a good reason why you believe the way you do. And you can understand that there's a good reason why I believe the way I do. And we can have that mutual respect for that, for, you know, that people are where they are for a lot of reasons and in their context, and that you just have to let people move through these phases. Something that Fowler is very clear at is that you can't try and move someone, that it's really wrong to try and like move someone, to push someone into a stage four. You know, I meet some angry people online who maybe want, express a desire to trigger faith transitions, which kind of means a transition through these different stages for friends or family members or church leaders. And I think that I would say that's, you know, and Fowler would say you can't do that. And that does a real unkindness to people, that this is about human development and people develop at the rate that they develop, and that you need to have respect that they are the way they are for a lot of different reasons. So you can't actively move people along. You just kind of have to let them be where they are. And for some people that's a hard thing to hear.
Yeah. Especially, because usually the people that I've wanted to move along have been people that I love and that I care about, and I want them mm-hmm. to understand me. And so mm-hmm. I think if you would just get this one concept, our relationship would be so much better, but that's not how it works.
Yeah. And so for those of us who've moved through a stage 4, there's a lot of pain, and there's often a lot of pain over relationships. And this is such a place where relationships can be damaged and changed. And I've certainly experienced that. And I know you have as well. And so we have this strong desire, please friend, please family member, please get to where I am so that we can share that faith again. Because maybe sharing faith in the past was a source of strength and peace and happiness, but we can't move people along. They just have to move along at the pace that their lives move them along. And sometimes these transitions are triggered by events and experiences. Sometimes it's a personal growth thing, but it happens on each individual's timeline. And that can be hard. But we need to respect that.
Yeah.
I think one of the things that I think about when I kind of look at this big picture is that there is something very, for churches to think about and for, us to think about as we, church choose and, local pastors, and is that, how can these people support the faith of others when the faith of others is going to look different from their own faith? Are they ready to support the faith of others? And can we choose leaders wisely, at least in part, by kind of figuring out where they are with faith? And how can we also then make sure that messaging and that church messaging, and I think Community of Christ is pretty good at doing this, that the messaging is coming from kind of a stage 5 place. And I think that that's both from leaders and in its materials that it signals that the journey stuff and that the journey is individual and we can, move through our journeys with our faith communities and that people in our faith communities can offer love and support, but ultimately our journey is going to be individual. And I think Community of Christ does that pretty well. But I think that that's something I'm trying to be more cognizant of, and how maybe different faith stages is going to impact relationships between people.
Yeah. Well, and I really the idea of being intentional about leadership. I serve on the pastorate of Salt Lake and I'm a priest. And so I just did my little priesthood ministry plan for the next mm-hmm. year. And one of my goals, and this is also to kind of help me, because I'm not super good at delegating. And sometimes I'll just take on a project and then I will do it all myself. And I can also kind of be a control freak. So sometimes I like just getting it done. So I know how it's going to be done. I can rely on myself, et cetera. But I really want to kind of maybe take people under my wings and help mentor people, which sounds weird because I definitely am being mentored myself. But this idea that, just identifying people that can be in those places with you. And I know Nancy, mm-hmm. you are very involved in leadership in your congregation and, running the show when your pastor's not able to be there. I guess this is just a good reminder to be intentional about, mm-hmm. allowing people to be where they are. And if they're still in a stage 4, support them in that. And then, mentor people who are coming into a stage 5 to then be able to say, okay, now we can turn around and be that stage 5 for people. And it can, I'm grateful that. Differently, because then that gives more models, more signals for people to kind of find someone, to find a model, to find a mentor, etc., to be able to work through with. Is that making sense?
Totally. No, it totally makes sense. And I just want to share just a quick little story, which is about a month or so ago, a good friend of mine just had said who feels called to ministry, was expressing doubts about her ability to minister to other people because she didn't have that kind of literal faith anymore, you know, that kind of stage three, stage two kind of faith. And she felt like if she was going to effectively minister to people, she probably had to have that kind of faith. And I was able, you know, with my Fowler knowledge, I was able to be like, no, you know, that's not what stage, if you had a stage three faith, you could maybe minister to stage three people, but if they move beyond that, you aren't able to help them. But if you're in a stage five place, which I feel like this friend is at or near a stage five place, then she can minister. She doesn't have to be in the same place, right? But she has been there, right? And she's going to use that experience of having been there and the kind of wisdom drawn from experience to support people with where they're at. And that's something you can do at stage five that you cannot do so well from stage three.
Yeah, that's really, really important to keep in mind, because sometimes I feel like mm-hmm. her, you know?
Totally, yeah.
Especially because, I mean, sometimes, like, I'll be talking to someone who is in a stage four, and then mm-hmm. maybe on some things, they still are maybe a little more literal in thinking, and, you know, yeah. So sometimes you think, mm-hmm. like, that I assume that what brought me into stage four is what brings everyone into stage four. And that's obviously not true, but
right.
I don't know. Like sometimes right. that stage three, it'll like smack me in the face when I'm not expecting it, I guess, you know, just in conversations, but I've lived through it. In the Latter-day Seeker context, I know where they're coming from. I know the culture, mm-hmm. I know the policies, I know those kinds of things. And I guess it's interesting of just how naturally it comes to just like want to walk with people through that, mm-hmm. you know, and mm-hmm. if I was a literal stage three, you know, if my faith was where it was at when I was in a stage three, and I was in a stage three for a long time, yeah, mm-hmm. I wouldn't be as, I mean, I would still be in an LDS pew in a stage three. You know, there wouldn't be a reason for me to yeah. be in the of Christ.
Right.
I hadn't really thought of it that way before. That's interesting.
But I think if we can think about, well, you know, these different organizations, whether it's the LDS Church or Community of Christ or online Mormon feminism, or, you know, all the other things that we encounter in life, or organizations or structures or whatever that support faith at different stages, if we can understand that people are drawn to these things at different times because they serve real needs of support in their lives, I think that we can have a little bit more grace with the process. Like, you know, our friends and family members who are in largely a stage three or a stage two or a stage three, you know, who are LDS, right? Like that's probably serving them pretty well. Mm-hmm. Right. And there may be issues with other things that are upsetting to us, but like there's a good chance that they're still in, you know, LDS because that is serving them well at the stage of faith. And, you know, and someone who leaves, you know, that is no longer serving them well. And I feel like that gives us a way to understand the process of faith transition in a more generous way. And faith transitions are so very painful. And it's often hard to be generous during that transition. But I feel like this framework has helped me to be like, oh, well, they're just in a different place, right? And whatever I feel or whatever anger I feel about whatever, you know, this person is just in a different place. You know, and if they move to a different stage, then they will need different support structures. And largely they will come to an understanding of this in their own way. And hopefully find the support that they need at different places. So I think that can help us to be patient with the process, maybe in ourselves and with others. And I think that there's a lot of good there. Certainly, you know, there's just a lot of stories of broken relationships through faith transition, and that's hard.
Yeah, I like what you said a little earlier about it gives you the benefit of the, or it gives all faith stages the benefit of the doubt. And another thing that I was thinking about too is how this is good for maybe congregational leadership to realize, like, if they have visiting seekers, because like just the last part that you said reminds me of, you know, if there's a family of Latter-day Seekers that come for maybe a month and the pastor's getting super excited And then, you know, if they stop coming for whatever reason, and again, the reasons could be a myriad of reasons.
Right.
But if they go back to the LDS church, it can be hard to not maybe take that personal. You think like, oh, I did something wrong, or the congregation wasn't fitting their needs, or, you know, whatever. But I like how you just framed it, you know, that people are where they're going to be, where they feel what serves their faith. And it's not necessarily like a self-serving thing like that you couldn't fill or whatever,
but right.
You know, it's just where their faith is, and there's really nothing you can do, and you shouldn't try to do it. Cause as you said, there's, I mean, it's unethical to be blunt, I guess,
right.
to try to pull somebody into a different stage.
Right. And that faith transition process, right? What you do if you try to pull somebody into transition is that you trigger a lot of pain, right? Without necessarily being, you know, because your experience is going to be different from their experience. And, you know, people can get stuck in different stages, you know, and you don't want to trigger someone else's pain. Maybe we want to see the other people around us, you know, grow to similar places where we're at, but we really don't want to like inflict that kind of pain. And there's no guaranteed outcome here, right? So we can't go around like triggering people's like faith transitions to suit our needs.
Yeah, for sure. And another thing, and so hopefully this isn't just too much of a side tangent, but I kind of wonder how this topic in general plays out with like restorationists that broke off after, you know, 1984, 1985, and like Community of Christ. Like, I mean, I don't think or know if anyone has actually done those types of studies, but I wonder if there's a lot of similarity. But that's just a new question that I have in my mind, I guess. But.
Sure. Well, and one thing I'm interested in doing now and in doing further research is to try to better understand, you know, how we would interview people or code or understand someone's language, like to understand what stage of faith that they're at from like a research point of view. Or could I download a body of someone's writing and then pick up on certain words or phrases or kinds of descriptions that they're using and be like, ah, yes, I can see that they are at stage, you know, at this stage because of the language and the way that they're writing about faith. And so I'm kind of interested in developing some methods around maybe understanding that better, you know, pulling some general conference talks of a particular individual and then, you know, trying to categorize their faith stage based on what they're saying in general conference or something. But that's probably a little ways off from what I'm ready to do right now.
Fascinating.
But a way of understanding messaging, right? Like what kind of stage of faith are they messaging to, or are they revealing of themselves? And I feel like that's kind of interesting. I feel like that would shed a lot of light on my own experience, which is the only thing I believe in studying. So,
well, I think your experience is relatable to a lot of people. So it's good.
Okay, good. Yeah.
And I just have to ask, obviously you are trained in art history. You just like pick up sociology on the side? Cause I got my bachelor's degree in sociology by this because I like barely scraped by, but I'm fascinated at how much, I mean, you sound like a professional sociologist, which is great.
Well, I do a great job of faking it. No, I'm trained as like a medieval art historian, which seemed like the right path when I was 22. And I'm not 22 anymore. And a few years ago, a friend of mine was like, I need write this paper with me. And it was going to be a sociology paper. And I was like, and it was about a contemporary topic. And I'm like, I don't really write about stuff earlier than like 500 years ago. And, you know, I don't really write about the present or sociology, all these things. And then I kind of dove in and we ended up working on a bunch of projects together. And now I see myself as more of an interdisciplinary person. And I think I've come to realize that all of my big interests in life have revolved around religion. Mm-hmm. And so that even if the stuff that I'm interested in with sociology is definitely related to religion, and the stuff that I was very interested in with art history was definitely related to religion. And so religion has been kind of a unifying theme in my life. And maybe I'm just through my own lifespan, coming to discover different disciplinary perspectives on religion. And that's just kind of how I'm moving through my life.
That's awesome. I'm finding, and hopefully we're not getting too off topic, but I really could just chat with Nancy for like hours and hours and hours and not even realize it. I've noticed how, just kind of a similar thing, just how much my interest in religion and sociology overlap, which I didn't expect to happen at all. Truthfully, I mean, I was kind of a sociology major by accident. I just took interesting classes, and then suddenly I met with my guidance counselor, and then he's like, you're 3/4 of a way to have a sociology degree. Are you majoring in sociology? I'm like, sure. So, I mean, I just kind of fell into it. But my program was definitely like a broad, broad overview of sociology. Yeah, it'd be cool to get a master's degree or something in it. But yeah, it's fascinating. And just watching, you know, human behavior patterns and how that relates to community. For me, my interest, I mean, I'm interested in like what makes a functional community, just a healthy, thriving community, which, yeah, tying that into stages of faith, it's just, this is like my dream.
Well, and I think that that's, you know, and when I saw all this stuff come together and was reading the stuff, you know, like I felt all kinds of lights turn on. It's like, oh, this is what's going on. My life makes so much more sense now, you know, and I love being able to understand, you know, my context better, because often the world around us seems confusing or overwhelming, or we think our experience is so very individual when most of what we think and do is probably part of well-defined patterns.
Yeah.
And so I feel like sociology is like the discipline that reveals this. And so obviously with Fowler Stages of Faith, we have a lot of psychology involved in that, but then when we're looking at the transition of Mormon feminists from one group to another, that behavior component is definitely a sociology thing. Pretty cool stuff.
Really cool stuff. What do you think how do you think gender plays a role in this? Because I mean, the Mormon feminist community, I don't know statistics on, you know, like the FMH Facebook group, but I would say that it definitely is primarily women. There are some strong, great male figures in there as well. But yeah, what are your thoughts on gender and how that impacts either the transition into Community of Christ or stages of faith and all that stuff?
So I'm trying to remember my statistics on the Mormon feminist community and gender, but I think the Mormon feminist community is about 90% women and about 10% men. Last time I surveyed them in like 2015, 14. Okay. I've forgotten, roughly, you know, 90% women, 10% men. And so I think that these things play out very differently. Women and men in the LDS church have very different kinds of experiences. And because there are lots of gender segregated spaces, we're not always super aware of how that different messaging is being delivered and then received in these gender segregated spaces. And when I say that, I mean that teenage girls and boys are separated into young men's and young women's groups, you know, at the age of 12. And then Mormon adults go to a different class every Sunday, where men go to high priest's group or elders quorum, and women go to relief society. And so there are these pretty well-defined gendered spaces that men and women inhabit separately within Mormonism and receive lots of different messaging about gender and how gender should play out. I think that, you know, we were talking earlier and I had hypothesized that I think that while I think there are very specific gender requirements for both men and women within the LDS tradition, that I think that the box that women are asked to fit into, this kind of conforming, you know, stage 3 sort of box, is a little smaller and tighter than the one for men, where I've often observed or heard of men talking in like elders quorum and in these all male LDS spaces and sharing a difference of opinion, maybe a wide difference of opinion or a narrower difference of opinion. And there seemed to be an acceptance that men could have different kinds of opinions, and that didn't count against their worth or their worthiness or count against them in some moralized kind of way. But I certainly can say that from my experience in Relief Society, that I haven't always seen a very wide range of differences of opinion tolerated very well. And again, people are going to have very different experiences, and I'm projecting what I perceive about men and their experiences from having not inhabited male spaces in the LDS church, but only having inhabited women's spaces. And, you know, other women's spaces and other congregations are going to be different from the ones that I experience. But what I feel like I've seen is less of a range of an acceptable range, where if you don't conform in a particular way, then that's often counted against you, not just as a quirk or difference, which might be how what I see the men doing. Oh, well, they're just different in that way, or they're just quirky in that way, where women might take some of those same differences in whatever way that they manifest and then count them against women in a kind of, well, that takes away from your worth and worthiness, or that takes away from your sense of like moral standing. And that's tricky. Like in LDS circles, it would be unusual for men to have long hair. It may also be unusual for men to have beards, or certainly be against the norm and against what is advised. It may even prevent, you know, some men from holding leadership positions, you know, something as silly as like having long hair or having a beard. Not that those things are silly, but the idea that that difference would really matter. But often again, not in every Mormon congregation, but in a lot of Mormon congregations, because conformity is so important, those differences do matter. In the last several years of my LDS experience, I wore dress pants to church, not informal clothing, just dress pants to church instead of wearing a skirt or a dress. And, you know, and that I really feel like that counted against me in some very significant ways, even though that's very superficial, right? Like, that didn't change my faith. That wasn't, you know, a different expression of belief. It was just a lot of things that I'm not going to go into right now. But that experience showed me that, like, that if I did want to break with conformity, even in very superficial ways, that I was really going to pay a price for that as a woman. And again, in a gendered hierarchy, maybe women compete very intensely for less power and influence. And that competition is more fierce, lower, further down on the kind of hierarchy than it is higher up. At least that's how I perceive it. So tricky stuff.
Yeah, really tricky stuff, but fascinating. Mm-hmm. Very fascinating. Well, I think this has been absolutely fascinating. I did go to your presentation at Sunstone, and then I think we talked about maybe doing a podcast, and you're like, let's do it after John Whitmer, because it's going to be way better. My presentation is going to be way better at John Whitmer. So I don't know like what you did between Sunstone and John Whitmer, but I'm really, really glad that we had this conversation, because the topic
me too.
Really, really interests me. And it interests me because to me, this is mission. To me, this is what we're called to understand this group of people, or I mean, at least I feel called to understand this group of people. Mm-hmm. And like you said, it helps me process what's happening in my own experience. I mean, I've shared a little bit, but as you've been talking, I'm like, oh yeah, that's where I was at that point in my life, or that's why I freaked out over this thing. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, so it's validating to myself, and also just validating to just the ministry that's happening around me, and the context of what's happening, because we're both in Utah, so we have a lot of these mm-hmm. same shared Mormon feminist spaces. And I think that sometimes I feel like because I have made the transition, and I know that Nancy and you and I have talked about this a little bit, but that I feel like maybe I'm not welcome in Mormon progressive or feminist spaces anymore, or it's like, you know, I'd like my street credibility has been lessened because like I left or whatever. But I really find the overlap between Mormon feminist groups and the Latter-day Seeker group fascinating, you know, to know there's mm-hmm. about 300 people just in that one particular group. It's yeah, that's really, really fascinating to me. And it shows that, you know, not that there's going to be like floods of people coming in, but that we have common interests, that we have common understanding with each other, you know?
And so exactly.
the community overlaps whether we like it or not, which mm-hmm. makes me feel like I still have a place there. So mm-hmm. it's good stuff. Thanks, Nancy. It's always a joy to have you on, and I'm sure we will have you on again.
Thanks for having me, Brittany.
Thanks for listening to Project Zion Podcast. Subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcast, Stitcher, or whatever podcast streaming service you use, and while you are there, give us a 5-star rating. Project Zion Podcast is sponsored by Latter-day Seeker Ministries of Community of Christ. The views and opinions expressed in this episode are of those speaking and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of Latter-day Seeker Ministries or Community of Christ. The music has been graciously provided by Dave Hines.